Of all our senses, smell often gets the least attention. When we lose it, however, the impact can be devastating. This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
COVID-19 has affected tens of millions of people. Many lost their sense of smell during the infection. In fact, that was a distinctive early symptom.
Most have recovered their sense of smell, but not all. Many people are still suffering from what doctors call anosmia.
Is there anything that can be done when people have problems with their sense of smell? Our guest has conducted promising clinical trials that offer hints for healing. We'll also discuss aromatherapy.
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, learn about the science of smell.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, scientists have just figured out how aspirin can help keep cancers from spreading. They've known about that effect for nearly 50 years, but because they didn't know the mechanism, doctors have not often recommended aspirin for their patients with cancer. The new study was published in the important research journal Nature. The authors note that metastasizing cancer cells are uniquely vulnerable to immune attack. When they're on the move, they haven't surrounded themselves with the protection that a tumor can mount. Consequently, the activity of aspirin is most successful against cancer cells in transit to other parts of the body. Aspirin is an antiplatelet medication, and platelets produce a compound called thromboxane A2. Thromboxane A2 suppresses T cells, immune system cells that attack those migrating cancer cells. By reducing the production of thromboxane A2, aspirin frees the T cells to do their job. This is basic research that hasn't yet been applied clinically, but the lead author notes, aspirin or other drugs that could target this pathway have the potential to be less expensive than antibody-based therapies and therefore more accessible globally. Although it's available without prescription, aspirin does have side effects. People should discuss its use with their doctors before starting long-term use.
Adding fluoride to drinking water is a common public health practice to reduce tooth decay. Lately, however, its safety has been questioned. Several studies have suggested that children exposed to fluoridated drinking water as babies have a modest decline in their IQ. A new study of 500 mothers and their children in Bangladesh confirms that higher levels of fluoride in the water are linked to cognitive difficulties, especially with verbal reasoning and sensory processing. This fluoride occurs naturally in Bangladeshi water. According to one of the investigators, our results support the hypothesis that even relatively low concentrations of fluoride can impact children's early development. In Bangladesh, the levels of fluoride associated with cognitive deficits in children are below the safe upper limit established by the EU and the WHO.
Does hormone replacement therapy for menopausal symptoms help or hurt the brain? Two different studies have reached opposing conclusions. A study published in the journal Science Advances used PET scans to measure amyloid and tau accumulation in the brain. These biomarkers are associated with dementia. Women who had taken hormone therapy at menopause had significantly more tau tangles in their brains when they were over 70. This was especially noticeable in parts of the brain involved in memory. In contrast, a study from Canada published in PLOS ONE reports that women with more menopausal symptoms are more likely to experience cognitive impairment later in life. The researchers speculate that hormone therapy might help reduce that risk.
Chronic, low-grade inflammation is associated with a range of metabolic problems, including insulin resistance that could eventually develop into type 2 diabetes. Researchers have uncovered a surprising way to fight inflammation and improve insulin sensitivity. Eat fresh mangoes. They recruited 48 overweight people and randomly assigned them to eat 100 calories of fresh mangoes or an equal caloric amount of Italian ices every day for a month. 2 cups of mango provides approximately 100 calories. When the study ended, those eating mangoes had significantly lower levels of insulin in response to a glucose tolerance test. Those in the control group had no changes in their response.
People bitten by a Lone Star tick may develop a delayed allergic reaction to consuming meat from cows, pigs, or other mammals. This alpha-gal syndrome can be severe and often requires emergency treatment. Several years ago, many doctors were unfamiliar with this mysterious condition. As a result, it often took years for patients to be diagnosed correctly. A new study shows that the lag between the start of symptoms and the diagnosis has shortened dramatically. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. How is your sense of smell? For many of us, a particular fragrance can trigger joy or fear. When I was very young, I was constrained in a polio ward for many weeks. Being in traction 24 hours a day was scary and painful, and whenever I had to return to the hospital, the doctors and nurses did things that hurt me. For years after those scary experiences, I could not tolerate the special hospital smell of disinfectant. Just walking in the door made me panic. Today, hospitals no longer use those disinfectants, but certain smells still trigger strong emotions.
The smell of smoke or leaking gas serves as an early warning sign of danger. Our bodies react almost instantly to something that we perceive as bad or toxic. Equally, when something smells wonderful, like fresh brewed coffee, just baked bread, or lilacs in the spring, it can give us a sense of calm or pleasure. If our sense of smell disappears or goes awry, it can be disorienting. A sinus infection, for example, can interfere with our ability to taste.
To find out why our sense of smell is so important to our well-being, we turn to Dr. Zara Patel. She's professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine. Dr. Patel is director of endoscopic skull-based surgery and is an expert in olfactory dysfunction.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Zara Patel.
Hi there. It's so wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Patel, most of us, I hate to say this, but we take our sense of smell for granted unless something smells really terrible and we want to get out of there as fast as possible. Or, as in the case with COVID, we lose our sense of smell. So, why is smell so important to our well-being?
Yeah, it's very true that it is taken for granted. It's often called the Cinderella sense, sort of the one that's not thought of until it's gone. And there are so many different reasons why smell is so important. Very common evolutionary defense mechanisms, like being able to smell smoke if a fire is coming your way. Also being able to smell if food has gone bad or rotten so that you don't eat it and make yourself sick. But even greater importance than that has to do with the way that we interact with each other as human beings and how much smell plays a role in that, although it is on a subconscious level. So first impressions that we make of each other, whether we think someone else is confident or anxious, maternal infant bonding occurs via smell, the way that we choose our sexual partners and our lifelong partners, you may think has to do with the way that people look to you or how compatible you are with them, but actually it has to do with how different their HLA complex, which is part of their immune system, smells to an individual. And so, you know, on so many different levels, smell is a huge part of what makes us human and what makes our lives the way they are.
Now, wait a second. Did you say that our immune system determines our body odor?
No, it does not necessarily determine your body odor. Remember, this is a sort of subconscious, so not something that you'll be able to pick up on and smell, like sweat, for example. But it is true that all of us emanate certain particles in our sweat and in our breath. And yes, your immune complex determines what those particles are. And that will be picked up on by other people. So specifically, when I talk about choosing sexual partners, we know that women are able to pick up on how different a man's HLA complex is, that's part of your immune system, from their own. And they preferentially select sexual partners and lifelong partners if those HLA complexes are different than their own. So women are responsible for the diversity of our species. Conversely, men are, again, subconsciously able to pick up on when a woman is in the most fertile part of her ovulation cycle of menstruation and will preferentially choose sexual partners who are in the most fertile part of that cycle. So men are responsible for the propagation of our species. And that is all based on smell.
This is fascinating. And I'm wondering how you got interested in this topic.
Yeah, you know, so I wear many hats. I'm a surgeon, I'm a teacher and educator, and I'm also a researcher. And my area of expertise is the nose and the sinuses and the skull base that we can reach through the nasal cavity. And so when I first came out of training, which is now over 15 years ago, you know, I felt very confident and competent that I could help any patient that walked into my practice. You know, I could do any surgery to cure their sinusitis or remove a tumor that was impacting their health. But there was this other group of patients that was trickling into my office that had lost their sense of smell. And I realized at that point that we actually had nothing to offer these people at that point. And that is really what launched my research into this area. And happily, you know, in those 15 years, after a lot of my own research and research from many of my colleagues around the world, now when a patient walks into my clinic, instead of having nothing to offer them to help bring their smell back, I have multiple options to offer them. And I've gone from being able to treat 0% of those patients to about 50% of those patients. And that's a great, you know, improvement, but you can see there's still a lot of work to be done.
Well, that is a huge improvement. And I think that the COVID pandemic really brought home to all of us how devastating it can be when you can't smell anything, because that means also you can't taste anything.
So tell us a little bit about why COVID caused so many people to lose their sense of smell. And we understand it can also occur with other infections. And what can be done about it?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, COVID-19 is just one of dozens of other viruses that can lead to a loss of smell and taste. And Terry, you're right that you know, taste is integrally related to smell. So about 80 to 90% of our ability to taste the flavor of our food and drink is really all dependent on your ability to smell it. It's only those very basic tastes like sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami that comes from the tongue. Everything else comes from your ability to smell your food and drink. And as far as, you know, how COVID caused people to lose their smell, there is a specific mechanism, which many people are now familiar with after so much media about COVID-19. It's called the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it binds to cells in our bodies via this ACE receptor. And that ACE receptor is not actually on olfactory smell neurons themselves, but it is prevalent on the supporting cells within the olfactory epithelium at the highest, deepest part of your nose that support the olfactory neurons and allow them to function. And when those cells are infected by SARS-CoV-2 virus, those cells, you know, have a lot of inflammation then, because that activates your immune system. And all of that inflammation can lead to damage of those cells and the epithelium as a whole. And so one of the really interesting and unique things about our olfactory nerves are that they are unique in all the other cranial nerves in that they have the inherent ability to regenerate. And that has been happening throughout all of our lifetimes. So we have 6 to 10 million nerves up at the top of your nose on either side that should help you smell. And each of those nerves, every 3 to 4 months, the nerve will die off and it should be repopulated by a new neuron in its place. But that process requires the functionality of those supporting cells that I mentioned, the sustentacular cells. And so if those nerves or if those cells are damaged, when it comes time to create a new neuron and have that neuron make the correct synaptic connections to the olfactory bulb and send the right signal back to the brain, that entire process is limited and may not occur in the right functional way. And so that is, in a nutshell, the basic way in which COVID-19 causes you to lose your smell. I think the second part of your question was, what do we do about it, or how do we help? And I'm glad you asked, because there are things we can do. Many primary care doctors or urgent care doctors may not know of all these options. And so if you are a patient and you're visiting a doctor and they say, oh, there's not really anything we can do about that, I would, you know, recommend doing your own research, because there certainly are things that you can do. The very first basic step that I would encourage everyone to do is what we call olfactory training. And olfactory training is really just a structured smelling protocol. This is, you know, the same, I explain it to patients saying that if you had a stroke and you lost function of your arm, you would go to physical therapy and work that arm as much as you could to bring that functionality back. And that's exactly what olfactory training is for your sense of smell. You take 4 different smells. The odors that we choose to start with are rose, lemon, eucalyptus, and clove. And the reason is that they're in different categories of odorants. And so you're going to stimulate different types of olfactory receptor neurons. And you just basically very, you know, sort of in a focused way, smell those smells and really focus your memory on what the smell is supposed to smell like to you. And you just rotate those through. And you do that for a long period of time. It takes a long time to regenerate nerve. So I have people do that for a minimum of 6 months. And that is olfactory training in a nutshell.
You're listening to Dr. Zara Patel, professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine. She's an expert in olfactory dysfunction and director of endoscopic skull-base surgery at Stanford.
After the break, we'll talk about getting your sense of smell back after a cold or COVID. Why do some people recover while others do not?
We've just been talking about retraining your sense of smell. How well does that work?
We'll hear about some other treatment options as well.
I'm excited to learn more about Dr. Patel's trial.
If saline irrigation is helpful, does that mean support for the neti pot?
You'll also learn about things that might be risky for our sense of smell.
Could omega-3 supplements be useful? What about platelet-rich plasma as a therapy?
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements, cocoflavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at cocovia.com.
Today, we're talking about olfaction. That's just a fancy word for the sense of smell. It's a primary source of information about the world for dogs and many other mammals. We humans don't rely on it as much, but it's still important.
Do you have a refined sense of smell? For example, can you distinguish between different types of cheese just by the aroma? What about perfume? Are there certain fragrances you love or dislike?
Without a good sense of smell, we're hampered. The world is less nuanced. And if we lose our sense of smell, it can be profoundly disruptive, not to mention dangerous.
If we can't smell when food has gone bad, it can make us very sick. Gas companies add a nasty-smelling compound to natural gas to help us detect a leak. If we don't smell smoke, we might not escape a burning building in time. During the worst of the COVID pandemic, many people lost their sense of smell during the infection.
To learn more about the science of smell and how we can treat problems associated with olfaction, we're talking today with Dr. Zara Patel. She is professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine.
Now, do some people, Dr. Patel, get their sense of smell back after a nasty cold or perhaps COVID-19 spontaneously? And if so, why some people and not others? And how well does your smell training system actually work for those who don't get it back naturally?
Yeah, so it's great because of that inherent regenerative system. About 75% of people will spontaneously resolve and get all of their smell and taste back, usually within the first 3 to 6 months after a cold or a flu or specifically COVID-19. And that is wonderful. But unfortunately, for that last quarter of patients who haven't spontaneously resolved, there can still be some spontaneous improvement beyond those first 6 months, but it is much, much less likely. And that's why we have, you know, continued to do research and try to figure out other things that can help bring it back, help switch that regenerative capacity back on. So olfactory training is one of those things, but unfortunately, it does not help everybody. And really, I would say it only helps about 30 to 50% of those people that we try it on. And that's why there are other things now that we have trialed that can help. Before I go into those other things, I would just sort of answer the part of your question where you said, you know, why do some people spontaneously resolve and others don't? There are some things we know that can predispose people to not be able to bounce back as easily from something like this type of infection. And there are so many different things that can affect our olfactory nerves and their functionality. So anything like diabetes or any other endocrine issue that's going on in your body can affect the functionality of these nerves. Metabolic disorders, renal failure, people with sinus or nasal inflammation at baseline that has not been well controlled, people who have had radiation or chemotherapy in the past for some reason. And then, of course, there is this growing number of patients we know about of neurodegenerative disease, where we know that smell loss can actually be one of the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. And if there has been any onset of that already, if you then get this second inflammatory insult to the system, those are all different reasons why you may not bounce back as easily. So if olfactory training is not enough, which for many people it's not, there are other things that we have now studied and proven that it can help people. So, you know, after I first ran that randomized controlled trial looking at olfactory training, you know, olfactory training was first being studied in Europe when I first looked into it so many years ago. Professor Hummel and others in Germany were studying it in a very controlled research setting. I ran the first randomized controlled trial here in the United States, and I chose to use essential oils that patients just went and got on their own and did the training on their own at home, because I knew I wouldn't have the time or funds really to be able to do that in a controlled research setting for all of these patients that had a problem. And that method of doing olfactory training, of patients just getting these essential oils themselves at home and using them themselves, is now the standard way of doing this therapy. And I want to make a point that this is not aromatherapy. This is not using essential oils to, you know, just smell a particular scent and have that scent make you feel a particular way. This is really just using the odor of the essential oil to stimulate the nerve. Now, if that's not enough, I ran a randomized controlled trial following that, where I added a high volume saline plus steroid topical irrigation. And in those patients who did that, they had a significantly higher percentage likelihood of improving their smell versus patients who are just doing the olfactory training alone. I took this from my experience with patients with chronic sinusitis. We know that giving steroid in a high volume topical irrigation gives us the best of both worlds. It gives a really potent anti-inflammatory bathing of the sinus lining, but we do not absorb that steroid into our body. And so you don't have to worry about all the adverse effects and sort of bad side effects of systemic absorption of steroid. And so taking from that experience, I trialed it in these smell loss patients, and that is now an additional thing that I'll have my smell loss patients use.
Now, Dr. Patel, when you say high volume irrigation, I'm imagining a neti pot, but that's probably not what you're talking about.
That is exactly what I'm talking about.
Really?
Yeah. So I guess I should make the caveat that neti pot means a lot of different things to people. So the classic neti pot of just a sort of high volume but low pressure pouring of saline is the classic neti pot. There's also a squeeze bottle that many people call neti pot, which is a high volume, high pressure irrigation system. And that squeeze bottle is actually the one that I have my patients use, just because you have a little bit more control over the flow. And we know it'll get a little deeper and higher than the classic neti pot. But yes, in general, that is exactly what I'm talking about, that 8 to 12 ounce solution of salt water, which you then add this topical steroid to.
Dr. Patel, I'm curious about things that can be, what I'll say, dangerous for our nasal passages. And the one that comes to mind is zinc. I mean, everybody got all excited about zinc against COVID. And there are studies that suggest that zinc might be effective against the common cold. But wasn't there some research some years ago that suggested that zinc in the nose, intranasal zinc, might cause lack of smell?
Yes, that's very true. I'm glad you've brought it up. There, you know, unfortunately, when things are sold over the counter that do not require a prescription, those are not regulated by the FDA. And so all the supplements and all of the over-the-counter cold remedies that you see at any drugstore, those are not regulated by any governmental agency. And unfortunately, yes, zinc nasal spray can cause irreversible smell loss, which we have no cure for. None of the things, neither of the two things I mentioned, nor the other treatment options that I will mention, can help people with that type of smell loss. So I would just caution people to be very careful about what they put in their nose and in their bodies through their mouth, because just because something is natural, just because something seems to be like a mineral or vitamin that your body needs, does not mean that you should use it in an unregulated fashion. And you can definitely do more harm than good when you do things like that.
So we now would like to hear about those other treatment options.
Yeah, sure. So we've covered olfactory training. We've covered high volume steroid irrigations. The next thing that I ran a randomized control trial on was high dose omega-3, speaking of supplementation. And the reason I chose to study that, this was about, you know, 8 to 10 years ago that I studied this, and it was in a different patient population, an endoscopic skull-based surgery patient population, was that there was a lot of literature coming out in neurology about omega-3 being helpful in both laboratory and in clinical settings for helping with nerve regeneration. And that's really what we want to do here. We want to regenerate these olfactory nerves. And so I took a skull-based surgery patient population who we were actually taking great care to preserve their olfactory apparatus, but a certain percentage of those patients were still having long-term issues with their smell, even after they had completely recovered in every other way from the surgery. And that's probably because right after that type of surgery, you have a large amount of inflammation in the nasal cavity during that healing period, which is very similar to a lot of different reasons why people end up with smell loss, including COVID-19. And so in that patient population, I randomized people to either, you know, just doing the regular rinsing of their nose, regular postoperative care, and doing all that plus omega-3. And in that omega-3 group, we precipitously dropped the number of patients who had long-term issues with their smell. And that same randomized controlled trial protocol that I used in that patient population was just replicated by my colleague, Professor Hummel in Germany, in a COVID-19 patient population, and it was also beneficial for them. And so this is another treatment option that I'll tell my patients about, regardless of the etiology of their smell loss.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Now, this omega-3, usually we think of the source of omega-3 as like fish oil. Are people taking this as a pill?
That's right. So some people will ask me specifically, you know, how much of it should be fish oil? Should it be krill oil? Should it be mm-hmm. vegan? And what I'll say is that I don't think that part really matters. At least we haven't studied it enough to know that that matters. And, you know, omega-3 is usually one part of a fish oil capsule. And so the dose that was effective in the randomized control trial was 1,000 milligrams twice a day. And again, I did that for 6 months because all of these treatment options need to be done for a long period of time to cover all of those life cycles of those cells. And so if you're going to supplement with this, you know, keep in mind it should be that dose should be the omega-3 portion of the pill. And then also keep in mind that high-dose omega-3 does thin your blood. And so I don't have people use this if they have an underlying bleeding disorder or if they're already on some blood-thinning medication.
Are your colleagues adopting this concept? And I assume you have published this research?
Yeah. So, you know, the people most familiar with it are those people who also do endoscopic skull-based surgery like myself. And that's a pretty small percentage of doctors overall. And so, yes, those people definitely know that this can help after that type of surgery. I think less people are familiar with the more recent study in COVID-19 and the fact that this may be helpful for any etiology of smell loss. So, you know, the more I give talks and the more I give interviews like this one, the more widely this idea is being spread. And so more and more doctors are utilizing these different treatment options, along with the latest treatment option, which is the thing that I have most recently studied, which is called PRP or platelet-rich plasma. Are you familiar with that?
I think I would like to have you explain it,
yeah,
please.
People are using platelet-rich plasma for a lot of other things as well. Tell us more.
Yeah. So, you know, I think most people are most familiar with it in orthopedics. People are familiar with joint injections for people with mild arthritis, trying to regenerate some cartilage in their knee or their hip. And I became interested in it again because I read the neurology literature quite closely because this is a nerve issue, loss of smell. And platelet-rich plasma or PRP is used in many medical fields. So in orthopedics, in facial aesthetics, people inject it into the scalp to regrow hair. And I became most interested when I saw this carpal tunnel syndrome study where it was being used for, you know, neuropathy of the carpal tunnel. People can either use medical or physical therapy to help that problem, or they can get an actual surgery, carpal tunnel release surgery. Or in this study, they randomized people to either that medical physical therapy arm or a surgery arm or an injection of PRP into the wrist. And not only did the PRP arm and surgery arm do better than the medical and physical therapy arm, but they were not significantly different from each other. And that's really when I thought, wow, you know, PRP really is doing something real here. And so I ran a pilot study before the pandemic hit, just proving to myself and others that this would be safe and feasible to actually inject into the intranasal cavity and that patients would tolerate it and that it wouldn't be too uncomfortable. And so I ran that pilot study and I did show those things. And I also showed an interesting enough change in patients' threshold at being able to pick up on smell in that very small number of patients that I trialed it in that I thought, okay, this is worthwhile running a true randomized controlled trial to see if it is actually effective in bringing back smell in patients who have lost it. And then the pandemic hit. And so I basically framed my randomized controlled trial specifically for COVID-19 loss. And I randomized patients to two arms, one which would receive a PRP injection, and the other arm which would receive a sham injection of saline. And it's really important to have a good controlled placebo group in these studies because, you know, our placebo effect is so great and the mind-body connection is so great. And patients are really desperate to have any intervention that can help them when they have this problem. And so I would, you know, caution people who read the literature or hear about things that might work, make sure that it has had a really well done controlled placebo-controlled trial. So after I, you know, randomized these patients, we found that indeed the PRP arm, after 3 injections separated by 2 weeks each, had a significantly improved sense of smell compared to the placebo arm. And the amount, you know, if you look at the statistics, it was about a 12 times odds of greater improvement in the PRP arm versus that, you know, sham injection arm. And then I just actually, just this last month, published a long-term follow-up study, a cohort study looking at PRP versus non-PRP patients. And this was both COVID-19 and other post-viral type of loss that I included. And it was actually even better results 1 year out. So, you know, I wanted to make sure these results were not only sustained, that they didn't drop down, but not only were they sustained, but they actually continued on an upward trajectory compared to those patients that had not received PRP a year prior. And so it was more of a 15 times odds of improvement in smell. Wow. 1 year out after that initial injection. So that's the latest thing that we have sort of proven to help these patients.
You're listening to Dr. Zara Patel, professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine. She's an expert in olfactory dysfunction and director of endoscopic skull-based surgery at Stanford.
You know, Terry, those numbers that Dr. Patel has just shared with regard to platelet-rich plasma, that's astonishing. 12 to 15 times improvement in smell 1 year out after that initial injection. That's fabulous.
Yeah, that's really impressive.
It's time to take a short break. In just a minute, we'll find out how our sense of smell changes as we grow older.
Unfortunately, like most of our other senses, it doesn't get better with age. Is there any way to slow the decline of acuity?
We'll also talk with an expert in aromatherapy. What is it, and what problems might it help?
We're always interested in scientific evidence, but it's hard to run a study when one treatment has an obvious smell and the placebo does not.
We'll also find out what our guest thinks about the use of aromatherapy in healthcare.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Today, we're talking about the science of smell. Have you noticed that your ability to detect fragrances has changed over time? Is there anything that can be done about that?
In a few minutes, we're going to talk about aromatherapy with a nurse who specializes in holistic and integrative care. How can our sense of smell be harnessed to help us heal?
Right now, though, we continue our conversation with Dr. Zara Patel. She's professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine.
One other question that we'd like to ask is, we understand that as people grow older, they may gradually lose their acuity of the sense of smell. Is that normal, first of all? And second of all, is there anything that can be done for that?
Yeah, so smell loss as we age is a real thing. However, the amount of loss of smell that happens with aging alone is not actually complete loss. So I've had many patients come to me in their, you know, 70s, even early 60s, and they have a complete loss of smell when you test them on a psychophysical measure. And they've been told by other physicians that, oh, this is just what happens with age. And that's not correct. You do not have complete loss of smell in your 60s and 70s just due to aging. There is something else going on in those patients. And sometimes we have a very good story of, you know, oh, yes, I had COVID-19 and then I lost my smell and that's why it's gone. Sometimes, you know, they had a trauma and right after that they lost their smell, it's gone. Or they have a lifelong history of chronic sinusitis and that's why over time it's gone. But there is a group of patients that I mentioned earlier where smell loss is the earliest sign of neurodegenerative disease. And when I say earliest sign, I mean years before other signs occur. And so if you are in this older age category and you have lost your sense of smell, it's typically not an overnight thing. It's not one day you smell completely normally and the next day you can't. It's typically a very gradual thing. Sometimes people don't notice it themselves. It's only someone that lives with them or a relative that makes note that they haven't smelled their garbage or they haven't smelled something burning that allows them to understand that they're not smelling and tasting well. And that should really be an indicator to go to your primary care doctor or a neurologist and get a cognitive baseline function test done so you kind of know where you're at. And even if it's completely normal at that point, at least you then have a good baseline to compare to over time.
Dr. Zara Patel, thank you so much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Zara Patel, professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine. She's an expert in olfactory dysfunction and director of endoscopic skull-based surgery at Stanford.
We turn now to Kathy Fritzi, a nurse with special expertise in aromatherapy. She practices holistic and integrative care at the Wellness and Support Center at the University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Kathy Fritzi.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Kathy, what in the world is aromatherapy? We suspect that this is not a topic that is frequently covered in medical schools, nursing schools, pharmacy schools, or for most other healthcare providers. Give us some insight, please.
Yeah, so aromatherapy, that particular term was coined roughly in the 1920s. And it has become more of a buzzword over the last probably, 30 years maybe here and around the world. And what it is using natural scents of the volatile compounds specifically from plants to support the health of body, mind, and spirit. So traditionally, folks have used aromatherapy just by, we'll say, using incense or maybe using the original perfumes, which are attars, which were flowers and plants that were dissolved in fatty rich oils, and the oils extracted the scents, and then they were used on the body application for calming down nervousness and anxiety, or maybe for attracting a mate, or maybe for supporting digestion, things like that. So aromatherapy now is used with the concentrated essential oils distilled from plants to perhaps diffuse into the air, or maybe be added to a lotion or an oil for massage.
I imagine that our listeners are going to understand this a little bit better if you give us a few examples, maybe a story.
Well, I can tell you that here at the University of Maryland Medical Center, St. Joseph specifically, we use aromatherapy in our Cancer Institute in the Wellness and Support Center to help patients just move through their treatment therapies. So sometimes these things can cause nausea or busy mind or difficulty with sleeping or pain. And using aromatherapies can help these folks to just calm down their digestive system, to help to open up their airways, to help to calm down their pain. So we use them here by diffusion. So we disperse a little bit of essential oil, could be of, we'll say, lavender, which is a very commonly used one for lots of things. Lavender has the properties of being analgesic. It helps to relieve pain, for instance, headache pain or post-surgical pain. It helps to calm down a very busy mind, or helps to bring up a very low mood. So we use it dispersed into the air, and simply inhaling. The beauty of using aromatherapy is it doesn't require any digestion. You can receive the benefits from the different aromas, essential oils, just by inhaling them, breathing them in. Some of the components are absorbed through the olfactory bulbs in the top of the nose and sends messages, neurochemical messages, back into the emotional center of the brain, the limbic center, which helps to the body to secrete endorphins and serotonin and dopamine and things that help to just calm down the body. So we use them in a session we call a healing therapy session here, where folks have the opportunity to simply relax on a comfortable table and to play some music. And we disperse the essential oils just in the room around them. And as they just inhale them, some of these aromas are absorbed through the nose and then through the lungs and dispersed through the circulatory system to deliver basically the information that plants hold to the body. So plants speak to the body in a way that it's they have their own language. And so we human beings, having evolved with plants and plants that have aromas, have learned certain things from them. The plants create these oils to communicate with the body and actually to protect themselves. So they help to avoid invaders and they help to heal wounds and things like that. And our body understands the same language that they speak through the scent molecules that they disperse into the air.
Now, Kathy, I'm going to ask you a question about the science, because you're at the University of Maryland, St. Joseph Medical Center, surrounded by physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and all kinds of other healthcare providers. And I suspect a lot of them are like, okay, is there any evidence that this stuff works?
Well, yeah, there's actually quite a bit of evidence. I will say there are many, many studies that have been done on the individual components that make up the volatile compounds of essential oils. And some to the various essential oils, like for instance, eucalyptus or bergamot or lavender, what have you. And what the challenge is that doing a double blind placebo controlled study with something that has a very distinct smell is very hard to blind someone to.
That's right. It's a big challenge. Now, I suppose you could use two different smells.
You could absolutely use two different smells. And those tests have been done. And what they're finding is that because you can create a scent in the laboratory with chemicals, but it's not as complex as the actual aroma from the plant, which is very complex, has over 100 different components in it. And each of those interacts with the other. And so it's a case of, you know, the individuals added up aren't the same as the whole altogether. And so I can answer probably more specifically. There are many components in essential oils. So the terpenes that are in essential oils, for instance, rich oils like pine or fir or spruce or juniper, those oils are rich in terpenes, which have antiviral properties. And then there are esters in certain oils. Rich ones would be clary sage or lavender or bergamot. And those have antifungal properties, which are very, and also are very calming and relaxing. There are aldehydes, which are profoundly calming when they're inhaled. And those would be contained in oils like lemongrass or lemon or mandarin or citronella. And then there are ketones, which are mucolytic. So they help to break up mucus and to breathe more easily. They also stimulate cell regeneration. So they help to promote the healing of wounds and tissue formation. So things like clary sage or jasmine or fennel. Then there are others that have alcohols in them, which are antiseptic and antiviral, as well as being antibacterial and anti-inflammatory. And those are things like rose and rosewood and lavender and chamomile and lemon. I could go on. There are more, but the essential oils themselves are a symphony of these different components, and each of them has their own particular property, which has been shown in studies to have these effects on the physical body. And those all together, it's like you could listen to a guitar strumming individual strings, but when you have someone who is playing a song on that guitar, it has a very different effect on you.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me as though it's pretty complicated, especially when you're using the natural essential oils, which you have made clear is preferable. How do you decide which essential oils a given patient needs?
Yeah, so that is about knowing the personality of the specific oil. And that's where it becomes actually quite interesting. So you can know all about the chemistry, and that's one thing. And then knowing the personality of the plant itself is quite another thing. And so, for instance, citrus oils are going to be very uplifting. They have a lot of what they call top notes, and so they're very uplifting to the emotional body. And one of the beauties of citrus oils is that they disperse very quickly from the air. So they come in and they sort of have their effect on you, and then they leave, so they're not hanging around. And then there are other oils that are more in the mid-range that are herbal oils. So we'll say eucalyptus or lavender, for instance, are commonly used. And they're a little more complex, and they tend to be very balancing for the body. So then I will add that there are other really grounding oils like frankincense or patchouli or vetiver, and they have a very deep kind of resinous sort of syrupy quality to them that helps folks feel more settled and grounded and in control, as it were. So it's not just the chemical properties of the plants, it's the personality of the plants. And so florals would be used, like lavender and rose and chamomile would be used to soothe the emotional body. And so they have an effect on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is your stress response. And the effect that they have helps to smooth that out a little bit, so you don't feel like there's just too much going on or like you have no energy to do anything. They rebalance that, and they're called adaptogenic plants, meaning they modulate the stress response in the body to keep you on a more even keel physically, but also very importantly emotionally. And one of the beautiful things about using essential oils and aromatherapy is that they have a very profound effect on the emotional body of the person that we're working with. And that's really important because, you know, stress is what undoes us all. And anything that you can use that will help to modulate the experience of the stress response, which basically turns off all of your body's protective and healing functions, is going to be to your benefit. If you can tamp down that stress response, and there are lots of ways to do it, you know, like our grandmas used to do it by baking cookies for us.
So, Kathy, it sounds like aromatherapy has science to support it, and people feel good when they use it. What's the future for aromatherapy in healthcare?
So I think simply including it in healthcare, and actually it is being included now in healthcare. There are post-anesthesia care units that use aromatherapy patches with peppermint and lavender and citrus to help quell nausea, which helps to decrease the amount of anti-nausea pharmaceuticals that patients need to take. Likewise, to help calm their anxiety. In addition, it's used in hospitals, things like, we'll say, sweet orange and lavender, of course, and Roman chamomile to help folks to fall asleep more easily without the requirement of using a sleeping pill, which has its own side effects and fallouts of being hungover and maybe depressing respiration and those sorts of things. So these are being used already in hospitals as adjuncts to medical care. And when we first started using them here at St. Joseph Medical Center of the University of Maryland, it was because of a joint commission requirement that hospitals use non-pharmacological processes to help patients with things like pain and anxiety and sleeplessness. And so that is why we even began to use aromatherapy here at St. Joseph Medical Center.
Kathy Fritzi, thank you very much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you so much. It's really been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Kathy Fritzi, a holistic and integrative care nurse at the Wellness and Support Center at the University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center.
We spoke earlier with Dr. Zara Patel, professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Stanford School of Medicine. Dr. Patel is an expert in olfactory dysfunction and directs endoscopic skull-base surgery at Stanford.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show, Al Wodarski engineered, Dave Graydon edits our interviews, B.J. Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with the People's Pharmacy.
Today's show is number 1,422. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning. This week's podcast has some additional information on why people sometimes detect strange odors that others cannot smell, as well as why some people have such strong reactions to smells that they become ill when exposed to perfume or detergent.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you can sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also have regular access to information about our weekly podcast, so you can find out ahead of time what topics we'll be covering. Speaking of podcasts, we would be so grateful if you would consider writing a review of the People's Pharmacy and posting it to the podcast platform you prefer. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week.